Well, we're working through the presidents and where they line up when it comes to their faith, their spiritual journey. Are they Christian? We don't necessarily know exactly because we don't know the hearts of these individuals, but we can draw from their words and their actions, their interest in things of the Lord. And so we come to the 15th president, James Buchanan. And as we've been doing, we've been looking at some fun facts. Sometimes they're not that much fun. And with this man who ended up being who many believe was the biggest failure of all the presidents, that's yet to be seen as we continue to work through history. But James Buchanan had a nickname. It was Old Buck. He was born in a log cabin in Cove Gap, Pennsylvania, on April 23rd, 1791. He was a staunch supporter of Andrew Jackson, but focusing on Buchanan's political affiliations won't do much to help us understand him. We do have these facts concerning him. James Buchanan was the only president who was never married. He had been engaged to a woman named Ann Coleman, and we'll hear a little bit about that in a moment. And in 1819, after a fight, she called off the engagement. She died later that year in what some have said was a suicide. Buchanan had a ward named Harriet Lane, who would serve as First Lady while he was in office. He began his professional career as a lawyer, but decided to volunteer for a company of dragoons to fight in the War of 1812. And he was involved in the March on Baltimore. Was honorably discharged after the war. Well, he was elected to the Pennsylvania House of Representatives after the War of 1812. He was not reelected after serving one term and instead returned to his law practice. He served in the United States House of Representatives from 1821 to 1831, first as a Federalist and then as a Democrat. He staunchly supported Andrew Jackson and was outspoken against the corrupt bargain that gave the 1824 election to John Quincy Adams over Jackson. Buchanan was seen as a key diplomat by a number of presidents. Jackson rewarded Buchanan's loyalty by making him the minister to Russia in 1831. And from 1834 to 1845, he served as the United States Senator from Pennsylvania. James Knox Polk named him Secretary of State in 1845, and in that capacity, he negotiated the Oregon Treaty with Great Britain. Then from 1853 to 1856, he served as the Minister to Great Britain under Franklin Pierce. He was involved in the creation of the secret Ostend Manifesto. Buchanan's ambition was to become president, and in 1856 he was listed as one of the several possible Democratic candidates. This was a period of great strife. We see that because it's the time just before the Civil War, and that strife was in America over the extension of enslavement to free states and territories, as Bleeding Kansas had shown. Of the possible candidates, Buchanan was selected because he had been away for much of this turmoil as the minister to Great Britain, allowing him to be distanced from the issues at hand. Buchanan won with 45% of the popular vote because Millard Fillmore caused the Republican vote to be split. Buchanan believed that the Supreme Court's hearing of the Dred Scott case would end the discussion about constitutional legality of enslavement. When the Supreme Court decided that enslaved people should be considered property and that Congress had no right to exclude enslavement from the territories, Buchanan used this to bolster his belief that enslavement was constitutional. He mistakenly believed that this decision would end sectional strife. Instead, it did just the opposite. Now, in 1859, in October of 1859, abolitionist John Brown led 18 men on a raid to seize the armory in Harper's Ferry, Virginia. His goal was to foment an uprising that would eventually lead to a war against enslavement. Buchanan sent the United States Marines and Robert E. Lee against the raiders, who were captured. Brown was hanged for murder, treason, and conspiring with enslaved people. The Kansas-Nebraska Act gave the residents of the Kansas Territory the ability to decide for themselves whether they wanted to be a free state or pro-slavery state. Many constitutions were proposed. Buchanan supported and fought strenuously for the Lecompton Constitution, which would have made enslavement legal. Congress could not agree, and it was sent to Kansas for a general vote, and it was soundly defeated. This event also had the key effect of splitting the Democratic Party into Northerners and Southerners. Now, when Abraham Lincoln won the presidential election of 1860, seven states quickly seceded from the Union and formed the Confederate States of America. Buchanan believed that these states were within their rights and that the federal government did not have the right to force a state to remain in the Union. Also, he attempted to avoid war in many ways. He made a truce with Florida that no additional federal troops would be stationed at Fort Pickens in Pensacola unless Confederate troops opened fire upon them. Further, he ignored aggressive acts upon ships carrying troops to Fort Sumter off the South Carolina coast. And then Buchanan retired upon leaving presidential office. He supported Lincoln and his actions throughout the war. He wrote Mr. Buchanan's administration on the eve of rebellion to defend his actions when secession occurred. Well, we look back and we see in the book by Ian Dale, The President's 250 Years of American Political Leadership, we see some history. We, as had already been mentioned, James Buchanan Jr. was born in a log cabin, something that was fairly common in the early years of the United States. His family were Ulster Scots and worked hard to establish a comfortable lifestyle. Despite some early bad behavior at school, Buchanan qualified as a lawyer and slowly earned a substantial income. During the War of 1812, he served in the local militia. He remains the only president with military service who did not serve as an officer. Now, he was a tall man, but a squint in one eye meant that his head tended to rest at an angle, which was disconcerting to those engaging in conversation with him. And from an early age, he had political ambitions, and he used his contacts through his legal profession to further them. And we saw that in 1820, he was elected to the House of Representatives, where he became the supporter of President Andrew Jackson, and he helped to organize the new Democratic Party. And from the beginning of his political career, he was a staunch defender of the Constitution and states' rights. Well, let's look back from the book by Gene H. Baker called James Buchanan. We see some things concerning his romance with Ann Coleman. And it was during this period when he began that. She was the daughter of a wealthy owner of an iron mine, the richest man in Pennsylvania, and a so-called iron master, this Ann Coleman, who lived just down the block from Buchanan's rooms near Courthouse Square. Coleman shared an important heritage with Buchanan. Like his own father, her father was a rags-to-riches emigrant from Count Donegal with Scotch-Irish Presbyterian roots in the old and new worlds. And if Buchanan was a prize local catch with his handsome, whiskerless face, Buchanan never had to shave, blonde hair and 6-foot frame, so was Ann Coleman with her slender body, dark hair, these beautiful features, dark oval eyes. And to compensate for this defect in his eyes, Buchanan characteristically would lean his head forward and cocked it to one side. He did this not only because he suffered from wandering eyes, but because he was also nearsighted in one eye and farsighted in the other. So some observers thought he looked as if he had a stiff neck, Others found it an attractive mannerism that would make him appear intensely interested in every conversation. At first, Ann Coleman was of the latter group and thought he was listening to her as she was to him. By the summer of 1819, the two were engaged in that informal way in which young Americans of this generation courted and then decided that they would marry. But by the fall, the engagement had ended. Now, such a disruption in a romance was not unusual at a time when women gave up their freedom and minimal civic standing to become one with their husband and, in common law, he the one. Meanwhile, men had their own reasons to hesitate before marrying. They worried about their ability to support a wife and their loss of independence. And at the same time that they realized the importance of creating a family in the new Republic of the United States. The apparent cause of the fracture in Buchanan's relationship was, from Ann Coleman's perspective, negligent treatment by an intended who seemed more interested in his legal and political career than he was in her. Ann informed her suitor that he did not treat her with sufficient attention or affection, and that he was only interested in her money. As for Buchanan, his reasons may have involved sexual preference, for there has been a long suspicion that our only bachelor president was a homosexual. Buchanan quickly left town, not in disgrace or embarrassment, as a humiliated suitor might, but in order to attend to some business in Daffodil County, where, according to local gossip, he spent time with another woman. Even the rumor of such a dalliance was sufficient cause for Anne to end the engagement. Soon her mother had rushed her off to recover in Philadelphia, where she had been a previously healthy 23-year-old. She died suddenly of what one doctor diagnosed as hysterical convulsions. And so when Coleman's father refused to let Buchanan attend the funeral or even walk in the mournful procession that followed his daughter's coffin to the burial ground outside of Lancaster, the former suitor became, as one resident reported, the whole conversation of the town. Meanwhile, Buchanan patronized his future father-in-law with a sympathy note in which the young man hoped heaven would enable you to bear the shock with the fortitude of a Christian. And throughout the winter of 1819, rumors flew about Lancaster as unfettered as the dry leaves from the town's elm trees. Had Buchanan's fiancée committed suicide after he broke her heart? Was she pregnant? Were the hysterical convulsions epilepsy? Had she taken too much of that medicine that was often used for insomnia? Why had her father refused Buchanan's reasonable request to walk behind the casket? After a few days' seclusion, the subject of the gossip was hard at work on an important case, getting a settlement from the Columbia Bridge Company. And so we see that he was able to propagate this myth that he maintained his single status. He was a bachelor, and he did it because it was a measure of devotion to the only earthly object of my affections. In fact, he informed a friend in 1833, when he was in his early 40s, that he soon expected to wed. That same year, he asked a male friend soon to see his intended in person to convey his love, but nothing came of that courtship. Suspiciously undertaken during a time when Buchanan was a candidate for the United States Senate. And in his 50s, when he sought a presidential nomination, he considered marriage with a potential first lady, 19-year-old Anna Payne, Dolly Madison's niece. But decorum outweighed romance. However patriotic, such a union might seem to be used to get votes. And as he wrote in a rare poetic outburst, a match of age with youth can only bring the farce of winter dancing with the spring. And so he aged and he contemplated his conditions for marriage. And so we see a man that is conflicted. And we also see a man who's conflicted when it came to his religious views. His faith, it resembled this confliction. He professed good intentions. We see in this book by John M. Wiley, The Faith of the Presidents, that his religious views in many ways resemble his conflicted ambitions in the presidency. He professed good intentions, but he inwardly struggled and made decisions that were outwardly problematic. On the one hand, his nephew, James Buchanan Henry, speaks highly of President Buchanan's religious nature. Says this, quote, "He was a regular attender upon church services both at Washington and in Lancaster, being a pew holder and always a generous contributor to both the building and maintenance of Christian worship. I have known him to give $1,000 at a time in aid of building funds for churches of all denominations, and many of his faithful friends were members of the Roman Catholic Communion. He was, to my knowledge, always a sincere believer in all the cardinal doctrines of Christianity. He had no eccentricities of religious belief, but accepted Christianity as a divine revelation and a simple rule for the conduct of human life, and relied upon it for the guidance of his own life. Meanwhile, his own brother, Reverend Edward Young Buchanan, a Presbyterian minister, said one of the books most frequently perused by him was the Bible, in the teachings of which he was a firm believer, and on the promises of which he cheerfully relied. He had always been a believer of the Holy Scriptures and the truth of the Christian religion, and besides being always strictly moral in his conduct, had been in many respects a devout and religious as well as a kind and charitable man." So we see once again that conflict where he's talking about spiritual matters, but you wonder, where is he at when it comes to Christ? Well, let's go back when he graduated from Dickinson College. And like most American educational institutions, and we see this in the book, The Presidents and Their Faith by Grinder and Shaw, that a curriculum grounded in Orthodox Christian thought and tradition, to this day, there's an open Bible depicted on the college seal of Dickinson College. So Buchanan's education there was likely not radical in its religiosity or lack thereof. Buchanan talked with his family about spiritual matters, especially with his minister brother and with his niece Harriet, who acted as hostess while Buchanan was president. And while Buchanan was minister to Russia, he wrote to his brother, "I can say sincerely for myself, I desire to be a Christian. My true feeling upon many occasions is, Lord, I would believe, help thou my unbelief." And these two sentences tell us that Buchanan knows his Bible, but also that he approached his faith with his thoughtfulness and seriousness, and that it was something with which he intentionally wrestled. To that niece, that beloved niece, he wrote this, "If I believed it necessary, I would advise you to be constant in your devotions to God. He is a friend who will never desert you." So we see most significantly, despite his religious upbringing and his clear religious beliefs, he did not officially join the Presbyterian Church until after his presidency. Part of the issue was they wanted to make certain he was actually a Christian, and neither did he wish to have his membership become a political issue. And while he was still president, he met with the Reverend Dr. William N. Paxton, pastor of the First Presbyterian Church of New York City. Afterward, Buchanan wrote this. He says, quote, "I hope that I am a Christian. I think that I have much of the experience that you describe. As soon as I retire from my office as president, I will unite with the Presbyterian Church," end of quote. And so Buchanan did join the Presbyterian Church in 1865. So he appears to be dealing with the particular Calvinistic dilemma that only one can only be a Christian if indeed God has chosen him. Being a Christian was not only a matter of belief or even behavior, it was a state of being, particularly determined by circumstances outside the individual's control and is established by the omnipotent God. Well, the second significant aspect that his statement to Paxton dealt with, the role of religion in political life. And we've seen that in previous presidents, they never wanted to act as if they had come to a final call when it comes to spiritual matters in the area of my denomination is the one and only. And so he seems to be respecting that. Well, sad to say, ultimately remember that Buchanan's presidency as a failure is regarded that way. It's a presidency that ended in the secession of the seven southern states, with Buchanan failing to take a strong moral Christian stand against slavery or to hold the Union together. And despite his desire to be a Christian, Buchanan's legacy is defined by the national sin of slavery. And so that's what we see here, but it leads us right into probably, if not the most famous, secondly to Washington. We come to the presidency of Abraham Lincoln next.